If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
When Johnny got the letter, it had no return address. But he recognized the writing, and he didn't have to guess. And the postmark said Seattle.
Now, if you're a real Chicagoan, you know that is the voice of Steve Goodman. That is a new re-release of some of his old songs called Santa Ana Winds, and I know there are a ton of Stevie fans out there. You'll hear more of it tonight. You're also going to be a fan of a sort of new writer, no longer alive, but his name was John A. DiMaggio. I'm going to read a short little thing that he wrote near the end of the book. Police officers don't ask you to love them, but just remember that they are the ones holding the seams of society together so you and your family can sleep a little easier. This is after he'd quit the force. He wrote, I still have flashbacks of my life as a patrol officer, a detective, and a detective sergeant, as if my heart is still out there on the streets. Sometimes I see the faces again, dead faces, grateful faces, scared faces. The book is a gathering of stories from Mr. DiMaggio's time on the Chicago Police Force. I want to welcome Raymond Benson, who is credited by the family of Sergeant DiMaggio for sort of putting together and shaping this kind of book. And he is an esteemed author in his own right and does a show with the legendary Dan Geyer, but we'll get to that when he's on all by himself. And Deborah DiMaggio, who is one of the three children of John DiMaggio, she's an attorney here in Chicago. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This book he wrote in retirement, right? Yes. He sat down by himself and kind of put together these stories, and then it was rediscovered in his effects after he died. When you got it, Deborah, and I'm assuming you and your brother and sister found it and said, wow, look, Dad wrote this book. What do you think of it when you first read it?
Well, he retired, and we knew he was writing it. And it just kept him busy and kept him out of mom's hair. So they retired to Las Vegas, and he had many drafts and rewrites. And we knew he was serious about it, but we really just didn't have any contacts.
Did he ever talk to you about it? Did he, besides saying, hey, it's like, hey, Dad, what are you doing? Hey, I'm writing a book. Was it anything beyond that?
Sure.
Okay.
He really would have liked to have it published when he was with us.
So this is, in a way, you're getting it together and publishing the book is kind of a testament to your dad.
It was a labor of love.
Yeah, you can sense that. But the thing that I must tell you, and Raymond, you came to this after, Deborah, you found the book with your, and said, hey, you know, Dad, these are pretty good stories. Maybe we could put it in the shape of a book and get it published. And that's how you found Raymond.
Right. I met a few members of the entertainment industry, and one of the directors I met was affected by the Peterson-Schuessler murders.
Famously, yeah.
In the 1950s in Jefferson Park.
Sure.
And then he just grabbed onto this project, asked me if he could write a screenplay. And then a few months later, I met Raymond through a mutual friend who's a lawyer, an entertainment lawyer.
Raymond, you have written a number of books. You've written in a variety of fields. You and I are going to talk about that when you're on in about a month to talk about your new book. I don't want to give too much away.
Exactly.
Well, what did you say? I mean, you obviously said, well, let me take a look at the book.
Exactly. Well, my friend said, I know this lawyer in town, Deborah DiMaggio. She has her father's book that she wants to try to get published or maybe, I don't know, fictionalized or edited or whatever. We don't know what she wants. So,
yeah.
You know, we had a meeting, and she turned over this huge manuscript. And
one of the things is, this is not an uncommon thing in life that the heirs and people who are left behind find a diary or find something, and it is in a manuscript that they get the sense that, well, this is a way to keep mom, dad, grandpa, great aunt, whoever, alive. And generally, with all due respect to the amateur writers of America, those aren't very good, are they?
Usually not. And yeah. See, that's what impressed me, was that I was reading this and I'm going, my gosh, this guy could write.
Yeah, no kidding. That's what I said, too. Yeah. And it's very thoughtful. It's extraordinarily honest. It's wonderfully anecdotal. Your dad, Deborah, seems to have a sort of photographic memory. I mean, the stories leap off this page. Perhaps that's the nature of the business, too, of being a cop. When you were a little girl, when did you first realize your dad was a policeman? He came home in this shiny outfit, the blue outfit?
Well, in school, they always ask, what does your dad do? Or you're writing your autobiography. So I knew he was a policeman, but I didn't know what policemen really did.
Right. When did that realization strike you? And are you the eldest? Are you the middle kid?
I'm the middle.
You're the middle.
Classic.
Okay, so maybe around...
When he was starting to make all those curfews and strict rules, I started to realize that he was bringing it home. So yeah. We were never allowed, as an example,
okay.
We were never allowed to sleep over at a pajama party. We would get picked up at 11 or midnight and we could go to the party. And when we would ask, why can't we sleep over? Their answer would be, you have your own bed. Well, my friends have their own bed.
Yeah.
But later on, he explained it.
Did you initially at that age, you must have, as a kid would, resent it?
Well, there's a little rebellion. My brother and I were pretty spirited and social and fun, but we accepted it. And we were raised with so much love and respect for our parents. And
where were you raised? What neighborhood?
It's the fringe of Chicago, the northwest side.
Yeah.
So it was St. Tarsus's Parish.
Okay.
And it's where a lot of policemen and firemen live.
Yeah, there
near Beverly. Edgebrook,
yeah,
Lincolnwood.
And on the north side, it's Edgebrook and Jeff Park and all that.
Right.
Because to be a police officer in this city, you have to live in this city.
That's
so
right.
So when you started reading this book with your brother John and your other sister Diane, when you, Deborah, started reading this book, were you shocked, amazed? Was it like rediscovering your father? Or certainly, your father could not have come home and said, come on, kids, let's sit around the dinner table and I'll tell you about this murder.
Never told us a thing. And I was all of the above. Shocked, amazed, newfound respect.
You must have felt an incredible sense of pride, too.
Yeah, he's a hero. He was a hero.
Let me ask you, I've known a lot of police officers in this town over the years, and one of the unsung, and you can address this too, Raymond, one of the unsung saintly creatures of this world are police officers' wives. Because they are dealing with it not in a way, you know, it's a little more intense. Don't you agree?
Very much so. And you can tell that from the book that
no question.
Deborah's mother was...
Rosemary.
Was right there with the family, you know, helping to keep the family together while he was out risking his life, you know.
Well, and also, so in reading his stories, you must have had this incredible new kind of respect for her.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you took what must have been, you know, it's very interesting. At the end of the book, indeed, the last line of this book is, there are many more stories to be told. I would imagine that the manuscript of this book was probably twice the size of this book.
It pretty much was. I think it was about a third longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was going to say earlier that, you know, when I first read it, it was the voice that came out. I could hear his voice. And that's unusual, especially for a first-time writer.
Yeah.
You know, it takes writers sometimes four or five books to find their voice. You've heard that
term.
Well,
it takes some writers 25 yeah. books and they never find
yeah,
their
exactly.
voice. He did do, though, he was doing an early kind of Dear Sarge, kind of not exactly like Ann Landers, but it was a sort of online kind of thing that he started doing really early. When did he start doing that and why?
There was a column
yeah.
when he was in Las Vegas, retired. I think it was Ask Sarge.
Ask Sarge, that's yeah. right.
And they would write in questions, and then he'd answer it.
Who was he doing it for? It was for the Mystery Writers of America, right?
Right.
So we obviously had these aspirations to be a writer. Do you remember, Deborah DiMaggio, your dad doing a lot of reading at home, you know, sitting by the fireplace? Do you remember him doing anything that approached the literary life? What was he like as an at-home dad?
We didn't have a fireplace.
Okay. So, Rick, you're romanticizing this whole thing.
He wanted to be a lawyer.
Yeah, I know. He went to DePaul.
He wanted to be a lawyer. And then kids came along.
Did he live long enough to see you become a lawyer?
Oh, yes.
That must have made him pretty proud, too.
Yes.
But it's in the book here. I think he went to DePaul for a couple years. Then he wound up going to Korea, right?
Right.
In the war, and came back. And why did he not pursue law? His father was a truck driver in the South Water Market, right?
Right.
I'm just showing off for you because to show you that I've actually read the book. Why did he not pursue law, do you think?
We came along.
But why law enforcement then, do you think?
You can speculate. I don't know. I think I asked my aunt and I can't remember. He just applied and got in the academy. They were looking for police.
I seem to remember in the book that he was working for his dad.
Right.
And his dad basically said, we can't afford the college stuff. And however, this policeman thing could be an opportunity. Wasn't it?
I have that memory, too.
Yeah.
One of the cool things in the preface to the book, and again, the book is called Sarge, Cases of a Chicago Police Detective Sergeant, 1960 to 1980. And if those of you were of an age and remember what those years were like in the city of Chicago, as I do, those were rough years. There are some very rough, tough stories in here. I'm going to spend this entire hour with Deborah DiMaggio and Raymond Benson. It's kind of their collaborative effort. I know your brother John and your sister were both involved in this, but this is quite a book. My new friends, Deborah DiMaggio and Raymond Benson, are in here talking about the book they kind of collaborated on with Deborah's late father, John DiMaggio, who was a police detective sergeant, among many things. The book is called Sarge, S-A-R-G-E, Cases of a Chicago Police Detective Sergeant, 1960 to 1980. It is the first of what I imagine will be two volumes here, because the book actually ends with him telling about more stories. Deborah was just saying off air, and I wanted to say on air, that the response from former colleagues of her dad's has been really great, and it's great to get together with them, and they tell stories. What are among their favorite stories to tell, Deborah, that are not in the book?
Torturing their daughter's boyfriends.
I love that. You had to be, I'm sure you had dates in high school and stuff, but you had to be a pretty together kid, boy and or girl, to go to the home of a child that you wanted to date who was the daughter and or son of a policeman. So I'm sure you had nothing but great boyfriends when you were little.
That's right.
Yeah.
We prepared them well.
What did you say?
My dad makes a lot of jokes. Just take it in stride. He really won't put a target on your face and pretend.
What has been beyond that, the response from and your dad and you too, Raymond, in here, do a wonderful job of thanking many of Sarge's colleagues, and he had a lot of them through the years, a lot of partners. I'm just gonna periodically read things in here. Chapter 8, which is called Fire in the Wind, Part 2, begins like this. When news came in that Dr. Martin Luther King was shot to death in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, my family was celebrating the birthday of my middle daughter. I was distressed at the restaurant and feared that another deadly disturbance was about to break out. However, that night the streets of Chicago were absolutely silenced, and that in itself was eerie. They didn't stay silent for long. That's one of the most moving chapters, Raymond. You were not in Chicago at the time.
No, I wasn't.
I was, and he really evokes the craziness and
right,
the fearfulness.
Right. The whole sequence with the sniper is just, you know, it's right out of a movie,
yeah,
I think. It's very cinematic. And he drew it very cinematically. It was just so expertly told.
Yeah, that's the thing about this man. I mean, he is one of those. It doesn't happen often, but he's a born writer as far as I'm concerned, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Here is a little later in that chapter. Tell me this doesn't make you scared. We were in the 4200 block of West Madison when a mass of people swarmed the sidewalk and street. They saw us, they knew we were cops, and they didn't care. Pow, pow, pow. Large plate glass windows were being smashed all around us. You know, I've heard Ed Burke, the current alderman of the 14th Ward, was a Chicago police officer at the time, too. And I did a story about, you know, 50 years after the Democratic Convention, he described it very artfully, too. And that was a rough place to be because none of these cops knew how to deal with this. Deborah, if I can ask you, when were you born?
You could ask me.
I'm asking. You didn't have to say. Were you? How old were you? Well, it's the same thing. Well, yeah, I thought I'd fool the lawyer.
In general terms.
Yeah, Deborah's a practicing attorney. I thought I'd fool her with a. Well, how old were you in 1968? Were you at what age when your father was terrorizing your boyfriends? At what age did you ever, if you did, get scared knowing your dad, when you started to realize what the city of Chicago was and what, you know, from reading newspapers, from watching the news, and then realizing that your dad was going out and about into this crazy place called Chicago, did you ever get scared?
They insulated us.
Did they really that well?
They really insulated us. And we just knew that he was making busts, and we saw him in the newspaper, or he'd be on the news, or he'd get an award. I remember a ceremony when he received the Award of Valor. But we didn't really, they never had us scared. We never realized what he was really doing.
Is your mother still alive?
Unfortunately, no.
Was she alive after you discovered the manuscript of this book and read it?
Yes.
Did you go up to her and hug her, I mean, even symbolically, and say, Mom, I had no idea. You know, I admire you 10 times more than I did when I was your favorite child, or whatever you would say.
We always appreciated her.
Yeah.
And she was all aces.
Yeah.
She was.
What do your sister and brother do? You're a lawyer. What do they do?
My sister's a pediatrician.
Okay.
And my brother worked at Lockheed as a rocket scientist.
So they raised three smart kids. Raymond, in putting this together, you must have had some freedom from the family to put together the narrative in the way, and you've done a brilliant job of it. I go from, you start with a horrific operation, but not the details of it. The details don't come till chapter 14, which is a very nifty narrative. Was it hard for you? I mean, it must have been sort of hard to figure out what you wanted. You're representing another man's life.
Right. Deborah will remember probably that after I looked at all the material, I just said, you know, really, it's just too massive. It's just too long. I've got to pare it down to, you know, the theatrical release.
Yeah, sure.
I did kind of shuffle some chapters that I thought would be, you know, more climactic toward the end, et cetera. He actually started, in his manuscript, he started it with that chapter.
Did he really?
He really did.
Wow.
He had the foresight to go, it needs to open with a bang.
Yeah.
And then the second chapter, I can go back in time to my early life. That's what you would instinctively do.
But, you know, in the beginning chapter, he's 38 years old and undergoing spinal fusions.
Yes.
Surgery, and you wonder, wow, what's that about? You do eventually find out what it's about. One of the other interesting aspects of this book, and I'm not going to blow it in this half hour, we'll talk about this after the commercial break in the news, is your dad, Deborah, John DiMaggio, sort of straddled two eras, the era of the real old-time cops, the guys like Frank Pape, who I knew fairly well. And he was of the new breed, and things were going to be done differently than they were in the past. That's a tricky thing in your narrative, Mr. Benson, to deal with, was it not?
It was. And
he realized it, though, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The whole sequence in the beginning, in the first part of the book, where he's working for O.W. Wilson.
Yeah, former police superintendent.
Yeah, Wilson was such an interesting character, and he really drew him beautifully. You know, I could just picture this guy.
Well, here, I'll read one sentence from that. O.W. Wilson was a legendary cop and the superintendent of police for can't remember how many years. And John was charged with driving him around. He's unbelievably honest in this book, and I'm going to read to you now some of that honesty. My weekdays as chauffeur bodyguard were especially long when O.W. was the toastmaster for an officer or a staff member who was leaving or being reassigned. The superintendent frequently became soused, meaning that I sometimes attended these parties on our days off so he and his partner could walk him up the stairs to his home. Ruth would meet us at the dormy and she'd take care of him. She had a lot of practice. Then the next line here is, I dreaded driving Wilson home some days when he would tell me to pull over and buy a bottle of bourbon. I mean, that is an insight into O.W. Wilson that you will not find any place else. You find it exactly on page 51 of Sarge, which you can order in Amazon and every other possible way. Sarge, Cases of a Chicago Police Detective Sergeant, 1960 to 1980. Amply illustrated. There's a really cool picture on the front of my old friend Dennis Farina smiling at some party, and O.W. Wilson is not at that party. We'll continue on with Raymond Benson and Deborah DiMaggio. Deborah is the daughter, the lawyer, attorney daughter of Sarge. And Raymond's a Renaissance man, as far as I'm concerned. I just met, and he's had a fascinating career, but I don't want to talk about him. I'm talking about him when his next book comes out. So stay tuned, please.
I remember when I met Carl Martin. It must have been a dozen years ago. This wise old gent was great.
Steve Goodman, ladies and gentlemen, back with a new CD. He's been gone for many years now. The CD is called Santa Ana Winds. And Chicago Police Detective Sergeant John DiMaggio is back, too, in a way. He is back among us telling incredible stories thanks to not only his daughter, Deborah DiMaggio, an attorney, and his other two children, whose names are John and Diane, but also through the artful hand of writer, novelist, Renaissance man Raymond Benson, who kind of... He was given a very polished piece of clay and managed to massage it and mold it into this compelling book that tells, if you were around Chicago from 1960 to 1980, you will get a real trip back in time. It really is very evocative of the time, and you'll get it from the perspective of a police officer who was in the middle of all of this stuff. The book also is sort of quietly honors Rosemary, the wife and mother, who doesn't honor O.W. Wilson. This is one of the great lines I've ever read in a book. I dreaded driving Wilson home some days when he would tell me to pull over and buy him a bottle of bourbon.
And yet Wilson's one of the best characters in the book.
No question. Yeah. And he captured the way he talks John. I'd like to. I met Wilson a couple of times. The other interesting thing, you get the kind of, there's a Miss Martino slang, the death of a woman in a housing, not a housing complex, a nice kind of apartment building out near O'Hare. And that's where you get involved with Manny Scar, who was one of the legendary outfit guys in the history of this town. And where Sergeant DiMaggio meets a guy named Bob Glickman. And he says, Bernie Glickman, he writes, was my first mob acquaintance, and I was surprised at how pleasant and helpful he was. However, a completely different Bernie Glickman testified at the inquest into the death of this poor young woman named Miss Martino. I was shocked when he said, Miss Martino was in low spirits and expressed a desire not to live. thereby covering up or trying to pretend that a suicide took place rather than it was a murder. One of the other interesting things about this U2 is learning that your dad was involved, even though it didn't take place in the suburbs, with the case of Valerie Percy, the murder of Charles Percy's daughter in, I think it was Kenilworth. How did that happen? Do you remember? I mean, he was a great detective, and I'm sure that Kenilworth lacked a huge detective squad. That haunted him, I think. He writes, it was my firm belief that the truth of the Percy case would finally emerge if all the agencies that worked in it came together and assembled the parts of the puzzle. That's the thought I carried with me ever since the investigation was dropped, especially when I read his quote in the newspaper. The case would be cleared, should be cleared for the anguished family in the sake of justice, and because Valerie's voice is still calling out to us from the grave. Anybody who remembers that case will be chilled by that.
I seem to remember that it was such a high-profile case that they had to get resources from all around.
Sure.
You know, and that's how he got involved.
Because he was a good detective.
Yeah.
What do you think your father would think of this book? Would he be proud of it?
Very, very proud.
What do his buddies think of this book, aside from telling stories about scaring their kids' boyfriends and girlfriends when they came over?
They're thrilled with it because it honors the police and the police force and the work they do. And I think the public really doesn't understand it. And I remember my dad telling me once that it's unfortunate that most people view the police department based on some traffic stop. And it's usually an unpleasant experience. But the public doesn't see the work of the detectives, the homicide detectives, the burglary, robbery, what they're doing, how hard they work, how many hours they put in, and the dedication.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, we're living now in a time where the relationship between, you know, people who live down here, for instance, and we're in the Tribune Studios on Wacker and Columbus in a very nice part of town, people's you know, relationships with police officers down here are basically, hey, where's the nearest breakfast place? And they'll get an answer. It's vastly different in beleaguered neighborhoods where it's, you know, some people are afraid of the police, and the police are justifiably afraid of some neighborhoods and some people. It's more, I think it's more complicated than it was in your dad's day. Raymond, what do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, well, just because of technology and you know, population growth and, you know, everything, it's grown a lot.
When your dad writes in the book too, your dad and Raymond, I think of them as collaborators. Do you, Deborah?
He wrote it. I just kind of
manicured it
and just kind of put it in order. And
but I hope I'm giving you good enough examples of what a fine writer John was. He writes here, and we were talking about being part of two, having one foot in one ear and one in the other. Some of the old-timers, he writes, seem to take pride in their ethnic insensitivity. I hadn't realized it, but when I became a policeman, I found myself scorned because of my Italian name by a few officers who punctuated their conversations with references to what they called, and then he goes on to name a number of nasty racial words. These usually were the patrolmen who became detectives because of department friends in high-ranking positions or politicians who took an interest for the sake of money. Your dad succeeded in many ways, and especially in the wake of during the nonsense involving the 1968 Democratic Convention, when I'm not sure I was around seeing cops get a bummer rap than they did then. Because your dad was a handsome, put-together guy who presented himself well, he basically started acting kind of like as a spokesman, didn't he, for the police department?
I think so.
Yeah.
He's super smart.
Did you see him on TV?
Yes.
And did you say, that's my dad?
Just took it in stride. It wasn't sort of run-of-the-mill.
You know, one of the things, and I mentioned this off-air, that your father bears a striking, almost spooky resemblance to the late Commander Bauer, who who was killed about a year or two ago.
Yes.
Do you agree?
Yes.
I wanted to bring up a big section of the book deals with what he called the Three Musketeers.
Yes, it does.
This was John and two of his cohorts, Jimmy Nolan and Paul. Was it Paul Ropel?
Paul Ropel.
And they and everybody in the department referred to them as the Three Musketeers because they were always together. They were always going out. Almost kind of rogue.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And solved a lot of stuff, you know.
Did it make you... Now I'm curious, Raymond. In this book, reading it, I never toyed with the idea of becoming a police officer. Well, for why? I don't know. Because it was 1968 and I was getting high in the Lincoln Park or something. I don't know. Did it... He makes it... incredibly exciting. He makes it tough. I mean, he gives you the tough parts too, but there's he paints a sort of romantic picture of being a cop, doesn't he?
I'm not sure romantic is the right word, but I would say real and gritty is it reads the way a true crime, say docudrama would play out.
Yeah.
You know? As if it was scripted by Hollywood scriptwriters, but the thing is it's all true.
Yeah, he makes it exciting. I there's no doubt about that.
It's like a modern day cowboy.
Yeah.
No,
I'm binging Rawhide. So
are you?
Yeah.
The old Rawhide.
Yeah.
With Clint.
I'm not. Yeah. It's old school.
You need some more cases. You can't be binging Rawhide of all things. We got to take another break, and we'll close off by asking these two fine people. And again, the book is titled Sarge, Cases of Chicago Police Detective Sergeant 1960 to 1980. There's an audio version too, right?
Yes.
Who does the audio version?
Kevin Pierce.
Who's he?
He's pretty famous. Okay, he's had 415 books, audio books.
Wow. How does it sound? Heard it? You haven't heard it yet.
I heard it when they auditioned. We auditioned him.
Oh, okay. Okay, how does it sound?
He's phenomenal.
How does he do all these voices, though? I wanted to do O.W. Wilson. John.
We'll get you the audiobook.
No, I'll get the audiobook. I'll get this on my own. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with Deborah DiMaggio and Raymond Benson to finish off this hour talking about Sarge. Welcome back. I have just about 10 minutes left with Deborah DiMaggio. She is an attorney, but she is also one of three siblings involved in the discovery of and publication of and finding the talented writer Raymond Benson to sort of orchestrate, edit, massage the book Sarge, Cases of a Chicago Police Detective Sergeant 1960 to 1980. Perhaps the first of a number of books, and maybe perhaps certainly the basis for a TV series, a six-part Netflix or six-part Amazon Prime or whatever they need to fill. It's filled with pictures. Deborah's father, John, was a handsome guy. He will put you in mind of, just physically at least, of Commander Paul Bauer, who recently was shot and killed in the middle of the Loop, of all places. You have a quote in here from Peter Nolan, who's been a frequent guest on this show, former newsman who's now in the process of writing a series of his own memoirs. He said, "Chicago cops are a special breed. There are few that you feel lukewarm about. You either love them or hate them." I think you wind up, and tell me I'm wrong, Raymond Benson, I think you wind up loving and admiring John DiMaggio.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he just, for one thing, he comes off as a very warm guy.
No question.
You know?
Sensitive is the word.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to look out for, you know, the underdog, and you can tell there's not a corrupt bone in his body.
Yeah, that's true. And he looks out for his partners. He seems to have a real... we're all in this together kind of feeling about this thing. Do you still, Deborah, when you had a book party, you must have had a book party for this.
Yes.
And you invited all of his former partners.
Yes.
And were any of them, I hate to think this, were any of them like jealous? Hey, I should write a book.
Well, actually, a few of them said, I wish my daughter would do that. or act like she cared.
Yeah, I wish my daughter would help me and get me Raymond Benson, too.
They're a real brotherhood, though. They're real. We raised him well.
Did you ever, did you or your sister or brother ever think of becoming a cop?
No.
Why?
It... He wouldn't allow it. It's too dangerous.
He thought
he wanted us to get an advanced education, and
we got a pediatrician. And we all did. We got a pediatrician, a lawyer, and a astrophysicist or whatever he is. You played the biggest part in getting this thing off the ground. Did you? Was there any reluctance on the part of your mom, who was still alive, Rosemary, at the time, or your siblings saying, maybe let's just let dad's stories be dad's stories in a box. We'll let our grandkids read them.
Not really. It was organic. It
was important for you that other people know of your dad's life. I mean, this is in a way a testament to him.
I knew he wanted it published. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. You must have gotten that sense too, Raymond.
Oh, yeah, I always looked at it as Deborah here, wanted to pay this loving tribute to her father. Is really how I saw it, and the enthusiasm and the work that Deborah put into it and organizing everything and was just it really would not have gotten done without Deborah.
What is Crossroads Press?
Crossroad is a small publisher that...
Almost all publishers are small publishers now.
It's an independent publisher that focuses mainly on e-books.
Is it?
And but they do print books on occasion for certain books, the higher profile ones. And they like to specialize on authors' backlists. Like if an author, like me, for example, if I have some books from, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Sure, that have gone out of print.
That have gone out of print, and I own the rights to them, then they will, put them out as e-books, and they'll have new life,
Your grandfather, Deborah, worked in the South Water Market. He started as a potato hauler.
Right.
How deep do your family's roots go here? Are they deeper than that, or was your grandfather the first generation to come here?
On my dad's side... Grandpa was first.
Did you know your grandfather?
Oh, yeah.
What was he like?
Phenomenal. Yeah. Jokester. Great sense of humor.
Well, he also seems to have been a strong man. Yeah, and also a big influence in your father's life. When your father had to go undercover at one point out in the strange land near O'Hare, where they wanted to build a new Las Vegas, Manny Scar and all these other guys, that your father used a driver's license and an ID card that still... said he was a truck driver in the South Water Market. And he said, Dad, that's a great story in here, too. Dad, if anybody calls, tell them I'm still driving a truck for you.
Dad made this book easy. All these photographs, he saved it. He wrote it. This, and to Raymond's credit, this was not typed on a computer.
I had to retype the whole thing. Yeah.
Yes.
But in doing that, there's a
sense of kind of editing as you're going along.
Oh, yeah, that's the way I did it. Yeah.
It's an important kind of thing.
Sure.
And you obviously have a great appreciation for this guy.
I actually typed the long version. I typed the whole thing out and then decided what to cut.
Wow. What about this person who initially, Deborah, you went to initially, who said, I want to write a screenplay, which is what everybody says anyway. What happened to that guy?
He wrote a screenplay.
And what happened to, where is it?
We have it.
Isn't it any good?
He wrote about two crimes. And we have it. It's somewhere.
And is it floating around Hollywood?
Well,
or is it floating around your law office?
Not yet.
Okay.
At some point.
Well, I think, the thing is that television networks, among them, are just searching for product now like absolutely crazy. I mean, they need material. And I think if Sarge gets in the right hands, I think this is This is born for a...
I could see it playing like, you know, the Naked City kind of thing. You know?
Remember that show?
Oh, yeah,
that
absolutely. Great. That's kind of what I thought of.
You know, you should be binging on the Naked City rather than Rawhide, for goodness sake.
Okay, I'll get tips from you.
Yeah, this is my tip for you and all of you other people out there. It's funny, you begin the book, it's really interesting, with an Irish blessing rather than a...
Oh, he did that.
Did he really?
He did that.
That may the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and the rain fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Did you guys go to church every Sunday? Just asking.
Yes, we did.
And your dad, obviously. That's one thing I find about police officers. There's got to be a higher calling. I mean, the higher calling is not the cop bar. The cop bar has its place in that life. But there has to be, and I think for your father, and tell me I'm wrong, for your father it was home and the kids.
Yep. That's all he cared about.
Where did he keep his gun?
On the dresser, and we weren't supposed to touch it.
Well, that's a good idea. No, smart father. Don't... Here.
It was a tall dresser.
This is the tall one. This is my gun. Don't touch it.
Don't even look at it.
How old was your dad when he died? He was relatively young, wasn't he?
He was born in 33 and passed away in 08.
74.
So it was before his birthday.
Yeah, that's how old my father was when he died, and that seems early to me, doesn't it?
Yes.
Was it devastating to the family?
Yes. It was a shock.
It seems, I get a sense, too, out of this thing, Raymond, that he didn't just miss the action and the being a policeman. He missed the city.
Yeah, well, like Deborah said, they moved to Las Vegas when he retired. But you can tell that his heart was still here.
Yeah.
Because he was writing these columns for Mystery Writers of America,
right,
or a newsletter.
Well, he helped a couple writers who I know,
yeah,
with their books, with information,
yes,
and background for their crime novels about Chicago. And I've had on this show, as you listeners may well know, lots of crime writers on this program. And this, as you have fashioned it, Raymond Benson, this true-to-life story reads as effectively and entertainingly and incisive as any crime novel I can remember.
Well, thank you, but I think it's really all John. It really is. I did was just kind of put some pieces together.
Well, and, you did a remarkable job, and Deborah, your father... Wherever he may be, he can be really proud of you. Are you a good lawyer? I'm assuming you're a really good lawyer,
too. Thank you.
Too.
I hope to think so.
What's your law firm?
We try. We handle domestic relations cases.
Like divorce, stuff like
right.
that. Well, good for you. Are you thriving in that business? If you and I have a lot of good lawyer friends. If you were friends of the lawyers you mentioned, Lorna Propes among them, who was running against Tim Evans for that job on Tuesday, I think. You know, good people. It's a treat to meet both of you, and it was a great treat to read this book. I greatly admire your father.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You'll be back. You'll be back in a month.
So.
When's your book?
October 8th.
All right. Set up some things. Set up some bookstores and come back on the show.
All right.
It's great to meet the both of you. We're going to talk more about books, including a guy, the father of the best quarterback in Bears history. That's so easy to say now, too. So please stay tuned for that, and we're going to talk about Pirates in New York. Impossible not to love Steve Goodman, and he is back with a sort of reissue of some old songs called a new CD called Santa Ana Winds. It is absolutely impossible not to love the work of Rich Cohn. He is a writer born and bred on the North Shore of this fine city. He's out with his latest book, but I want to tell you, he's been a frequent guest on this show, and he's wildly prolific. And I'm just going to, his first book was something called Tough Jews, which has some relationship to my 10:30 guest. Sid Luckman was a tough Jew, and his father was even crazier. But also, Rich has written one of, I don't know, Rich, how are you? I'm rambling on like an idiot. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm rambling on like an idiot. I was going to say like 20, say 15 sentences about each of your books, and the segment would be over. One of the books that I just adored was The Fish That Ate the Whale, was an astonishing, astonishing book about guy named the Banana King. Then there was, of course, Monsters, the 85 Chicago Bears, and The Wild Heart of Football. I need to ask you if you saw the recent game and if you still think this is the Wild Heart of Football in Chicago. That was the worst football game I can remember seeing.
It was bad. It was like, I could talk about it forever, but basically, you know, the 85 Bears, they one thing that Doug Plank, who was actually the namesake of the 46 defense, so he wasn't on the team, said to me, his entire career now would be considered a penalty. So I just figure we're in a different era. Completely has to be judged.
It is a different era. And having watched that game, I thought, wow, now we're in the boring era of football. Then The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones was a fabulous book. We had you on the show about that. Then The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, was one of the most charming. That book must still be selling like crazy, is it not?
Yeah, it's doing really well. I mean, it would be helpful if the Cubs would win some games, you know, and close the gap with the Cardinals. That would help me a lot, personally and professionally. But
I think it's looking bleak at the moment. Rich is on the phone from his home in Connecticut that he shares with his lovely wife and kids. His latest book is just, he always finds these characters that I've, in many cases, that I've never even heard of. The character in Tough Jews was filled with them. But The Last Pirate of New York is a further title, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. I need to ask you, before we get deep into the book, Rich, how did you even come upon this story? I know you're a tireless researcher and you love digging around, you know, archives and various files, but how did you come upon this story?
Well, it was when I was researching Tough Jews. Tough Jews is basically about Jewish gangsters from Brooklyn. I grew up in Glencoe, but my father, instead of regular bedtime stories, would tell me stories about guys like Abe Kitch with Relis and Danny Cohen and Happy Levine. And when I moved to New York, I wanted to find out if there was any truth to his stories, you know. So I started researching his stories. They're all stuff that happened in Brooklyn in the 1930s and 40s. When I met some of these little guys and started hearing their stories, they kept talking about this guy, Albert Hicks, who was the first pirate. I mean, the first gangster. It goes back so old in New York history that he was not even called a gangster. He was called a pirate.
Right.
He was like the Paul Bunyan of the New York underworld when it was just pre-Civil War, and it was just an unbelievable time of violence just on the verge of the modern era. And I just became completely fascinated by this guy who's sort of the missing link between Bluebeard and John Gotti.
Yeah, that's a big link, man. That's a very interesting link. That the one thing about this book that I found, and I devoured it in, you know, a couple hours, is it is wildly entertaining and at the same time absolutely chilling. This is one of the great monsters of American crime.
Yeah, he was an absolute psychopath, and he ultimately confessed over 100 murders all over the world. He was a pirate on whaling ships. So, but to me, it was sort of like how this guy who was insane became kind of like an anti-hero for people in the slums, and how over time his story was kind of rewritten to make him more palatable, which was to make him a victim before he was a criminal. And to me, he was just sort of almost the founder of the New York underworld. He kind of was like you had Fiorello LaGuardia up above and this guy down below.
Yeah, and he dressed, he didn't just act the part and murder the part. He dressed the part too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. So that was part of the thing, which was, yeah. You know, he was under a fake name and people knew of his crimes. But there was a big manhunt, one of the biggest manhunts in the whole country at that time. And when they brought him back, thousands of people stood on the train stations to see him. When they got him back, people were shocked because he was so handsome. They were actually upset by it. You know, they wanted some explanation for it, and he was an unbelievably great dresser. And I actually wrote a thing in the New York Times sort of arguing that he's the guy that created the whole style that you still see reflected in guys like John Gotti wearing, you know, the thin yellow socks sitting out on the corner, you know, in Lower Manhattan, or the guys like in Guys and Dolls. Damon Runyon stories.
Yeah.
He sort of created that whole style. Yeah.
It is called, again, the book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of Gangster Nation. What you really should do is go to Rich's site, which is authorrichcohen.com. He has also started, I want to talk a little too about, he has also started writing an unbelievably compelling column for the Paris Review. The Paris Review, the esteemed publication started by, among others, the very well-known George Plimpton. I literally stumbled. I mean, you and I are friends, and I read everything you write, but sometimes I'm surprised. All of a sudden, I'm looking at the Paris Review website, and there is my buddy Rich Cohn writing about Stanley Kubrick and moon landings and conspiracy theories. How did that come to be, Rich? You've written for the Paris Review before, of course.
Yeah, they just came to me after they ran a piece of the new book, the pirate book, and they said, hey, do you want to write a column for us? It's like a new thing that we're doing. And I said, sure. I mean, I love the Paris Review, and I've always wanted to write a column. It's sort of my fantasy. So, and they said, come up with an idea. And I said, how about conspiracy theories? Very broadly defined. Just really strange, weird stuff. I'm supposed to do six of them. The first one was about the moon landing, and was it faked, and was Stanley Kubrick's movie 2001, The Shining, a hidden confession about his role in faking the moon landing. And the one that just did most recently was about
UFOs.
Because there's been all this recent stuff, you know, even like at O'Hare Airport, there was this UFO sighting, and these pilots, Navy pilots coming out and saying that they saw UFOs off the coast of, I think, Carolina. So, just exploring that, and that could go down that rabbit hole for forever.
Well, that must be, that's got to be, I can sense in the writing a certain joyfulness at your exploring these things, as if you've walked into some kind of fun house and you're describing it. Your writing is astonishingly lively in there, Rich. You have had, and I want to talk about it, not just in terms of The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship. I want to sort of nurture a large crowd of Rich Cohn readers out there, as my girlfriend Kate has become a huge fan. And, you know, she became a huge fan with Monsters, and she's sort of a football fan. So I want to do that after a short commercial break, talk to you about what it is that grabs you. I understand why Tough Jews grabbed you. And the other thing about your work is you are never loathe, and I think very effective at putting yourself and your past in virtually every book you wrote. You also wrote or co-wrote with the one and only Jerry Weintraub, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. So your bookshelf is an astonishment as far as I'm concerned. We'll be back in 2 minutes with author Rich Cohn live from Connecticut. While you're watching the Cubs game, it would behoove you to read the best book written about the Cubs in recent memory, called The Chicago Cubs Story of a Curse. Rich Cohn, the author of that book and many more. What was the seed of that book, Rich? I know you had written, I think you wrote a piece for the Paris Review about, you know, Babe Ruth's called shot, I think, for some other magazine for which you write. What was the impetus for the Cubs book?
Well, I was a giant Cubs fan, and probably being a Cubs fan created my entire worldview. And the 1984 Cubs
so sad
broke my heart.
So sad.
Yeah, they just like me being cast out of Eden. And my father always said, and it's like the basis of everything, is that he used to beg me not to be a Cubs fan. He said, Cubs fan will have a bad life because he'll accept losing as a natural state of the world and accept less out of himself and won't be happy and all this stuff. We got in big, huge fights about it. He was, of course, a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, yeah. So, because you grew up in Brooklyn. And so the Cubs appear, like, in all of my work. So there, I wrote this story for Harper's Magazine where I traveled around with the Cubs to try to figure out why they couldn't win. That was, like, in 1999. That was the Sammy Sosa Cubs. They lost, like, 12 games in a row when I was with them. That's the worst place to be in a baseball team's clubhouse after they've lost a 12th game in a row.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, it was bad. And then even my book Lake Effect, which is about growing up in Glencoe, there's a whole thing about the Cubs. And even the Bears, see, I always said, like, the reason why I became so involved with the Bears, though I was a fan in 85, is they became more than a regular team, is because, like, the 84 Cubs killed me, and the 85 Bears brought me back to life.
So salvation. Like, salvation.
In that movie all gray, and they unzipped the bag somehow. So, and there's a whole section in that book about the 84 Cubs, and the fact that my brother was so upset when the Super Bowl Shuffle came out because the 69 Cubs had done that song, you know, the Hey Hey song, and the 84 Cubs had a song, which people don't remember, but I still have the 45, which is called Men in Blue, where Leon Durham and Jody Davis, they all sing this song, and they sing, as sure as the ivy is on the center field wall, the Men in Blue are going to win it all, and they didn't. I mean, they didn't even get to the World Series that year, so... it's deep, the scar in my soul is the Cubs. So when Cubs were, and I was writing stories all along as they got better for Sports Illustrated, and then when they actually won the World Series, or when it looked like I was sure they were going to because the team seemed so good, I just decided I got to write this book. And it's the first time I've ever really written a book where I felt like I had to write it pretty quickly because I went to the World Series and wrote it right after.
Yeah, but there's an intimacy. One of the things that really characterizes your work, Rich Cohn, is there is an intimacy to all of it. And I don't mean it's just that, oh, you know, Tough Jews being the result of your hearing, you know, stories from your dad about his childhood in Brooklyn. There's something else. You are not loath to expose yourself and your own feelings and your own history in the books, especially the Rolling Stones book, is filled with that kind of introspective honesty. Is that a conscious thing, Rich? I know this is a real writerly kind of question, but do you do it consciously, or do you, I think it enriches the story.
I think it's conscious, and I think one of the writers that really had a big influence on me, which some people don't know him, you know, at all, is Joseph Mitchell, who was this great New Yorker writer who I met. I was a receptionist at the New Yorker. He was an old guy wearing a seersucker suit, and I was able to become friendly with him. And in his stuff, which I love so much, whenever he comes in, there's a whole other level of awesomeness to it. And something about the way when once he's in those stories, you feel like every detail in the story is him. Yeah. You know, so he doesn't have to write about himself, but it's still him all over the story. It's all you're in his world the whole entire time. So I think that had a big influence on me. And then also just the fact that I just have a problem where I like to talk about myself a lot and tell a lot of my own stories. So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's too much, but I'm too old to change it now.
Hey, and I always take incredible advantage of that all the time. It's interesting that I have on, I mean, this is like the North Shore Writers Hour. Do you know about this? A book by the author I'm having on, R.D. Rosen, who's going to be on at 10:30 talking about Tough Luck. I know you know about this. Tough Luck, Sid Luckman, Murder, Inc., and the Rise of the Modern NFL.
I do know about that, and I did a story about it.
I know.
Tablet, yeah. And I know about the book because I know Peter Luckman, who's Sid Luckman's nephew, lives in our town, and he was telling me about it. I have the book. I think the book's really great. And I know he's from Highland Park.
Yeah,
I read the book.
I know.
And you know, it's just interesting the idea that there's this, that behind Sid Luckman is this really grisly murder story, which was kept out of the papers, pretty much. I mean, it was in the papers, but it wasn't connected to Sid Luckman. So it's fascinating.
Yeah,
and it's also sort of, I always thought somehow the violence of the NFL is sort of all in there. Sid Luckman's life is. And, you know, you forget, like, this goes back to Tough Jews and all that, because what Sid Luckman was before he was on the Bears, before he played for Columbia, was he was a playground legend in Brooklyn.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And by the way, Otis Wilson from the same, I think the same high school maybe. So there is this tradition in Brooklyn of kind of these guys who are just great athletes in every sport in the neighborhood and end up on the Bears. And that's what was so great about George Halas, is finding and recognizing those guys.
Well, one of the things, Sid Luckman must have been, I'm not assuming to know your dad, but Sid Luckman must have been a kind of hero to your father's generation, yes?
Yes, but weirdly, you know, they weren't giant NFL fans.
Yeah, because the NFL...
They were baseball.
Yeah. I mean,
baseball and basketball fans.
What are you thinking of in doing the last Pirate of New York, which is, you know, one of the things about your books, I'm sure they get movie nibbles all the time, yes?
Yeah. I think every single thing I've written right now is under options somewhere, but, you know.
Isn't that a lovely... Well, the lovely world of options is they do give you some money, but you get a lot more money if they ever start to make the movie. So the world of options is a very interesting place. This one must have been. I would think, you know, I'd hate to see, you know, some idiot like Johnny Depp play this guy, because I think it's a much more... He's a much more nuanced, interesting character... Albert Hicks. Who do you see playing Albert Hicks if there is a movie?
Well, there's some actors I really like. There's Sam Worthington, who was in Avatar.
Mm.
And Michael Fassbender, I could see playing him.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I'm right now, I've been working. I think it will be made into a movie or a show. And I've been very smart and very careful in this, and not sort of willy-nilly going out and selling it to anybody that wants to buy it. But there's a friend of mine from, I think he grew up in Wilmette, who's a movie producer named Neil Edelstein, who's just like a guy I knew growing up, and I've been working with him. So that's how I want to do stuff from now on.
I think the thing is, we just got to stay all Chicago all the time. I mean, I think we can do everything.
Once you leave Chicago, you get yourself in. Look at me, I'm in Connecticut, and I'm a mess. I'm a total
wreck. You're not a mess. You got great kids, and you're not a total mess. And do you ever run into Keith Richard ever drink at the neighborhood bar anymore? Is he, they're on the road now.
Well, I heard the other day that I went to our local bookstore, and they told me that Jose Feliciano's drummer had come in and bought my Rolling Stones book.
Is that
right? Like, that's really cool. It'd be really cool if it was Jose Feliciano, but that's second best. But... The thing is, because Jose Feliciano and Keith Richards live in the same town, and the joke is it's Weston, Connecticut. Keith Richards is the second best guitar player in Weston, Connecticut.
What are you working on now? You've got this book, The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation, which I devoured in, you know, a couple hours, because I love your writing, but this story just caught me so off guard. I'd never heard of this guy before, and you do make the case that he is kind of the avatar for, you know, the guy, people, idiots like John Gotti, for God's sake, but, you know, they made into a kind of strange hero, and he was a brutal, brutal guy. I got to believe that there is a ton of work involved in the seamless reading that is your conspiracy column. You've got two under your belt. The second one about UFOs is fascinating. The first one about Stanley Kubrick maybe apologizing for faking the moon landing with hints in The Shining. Yeah. There's a lot of work in that. I know that kind of research for you is fun, but how do you just wait around to stumble upon? I know you do a lot of reading. I know you talk to a lot of people. Stumble upon your next conspiracy? How does that happen?
Well, I have ideas that I just kind of come across them and I write them down. And some stuff I've been interested in for a long time. Usually I wanted to connect to something deeper. I mean, I was interested in the moon landing, because to me that's like the beginning of the modern sort of mind that everything's crooked and you can't believe anything. The UFO thing, I don't know. The fact that they reported sightings of UFOs on the cover of the front page of the New York Times just blows my mind. And lately I've been kind of obsessed with the Denver airport. I don't know if you've heard about the Denver airport, but look into that and the conspiracy theories revolving around the new, which isn't so new anymore, but the newer Denver airport, and as some sort of hub for international global conspiracy, and that's kind of, and that and chemtrails are the two things.
Rich,
mostly because
you have, Rich Cohn has made his mark with books in the wickedest era in the history of American publishing. It's not been this bad since Gutenberg was a baby, and you have done a remarkable book. I mean, my bookshelf is filled with these books, and the one, talk to me for 2 seconds before I let you go and go play with your family. The Fish That Ate the Whale is one of the most, again, it's a story that I never heard about. It's about the Banana King.
Yeah. Well, that's just a story about this guy, that a Russian Jewish immigrant who ended up in Selma, Alabama, saw a banana and fell in love and decided that he was going to bring bananas to the North. And he sort of ended up buying these bananas that were being discarded as rotten and selling them. And it's just a classic story of an immigrant spotting hidden value. And it's sort of like one man's trash is one man's treasure. And he winds up, in the end, becoming one of the most powerful people in America and running the United States.
And running Nicaragua. It's an astonishing story. Just go to author Rich Cohn and just start ordering books. I would start, a good one to start with would be The Last Part of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and The Birth of a Gangster Nation. Or if you're unbelievably depressed by the recent Bears charming loss, Monsters, the 85 Chicago Bears, and The Wild Heart of Football. He really gets very intimate interviews with a number of the members, if not all the members of that team, including a sad, sad Jim McMahon, who seems to bounce back a little, but still a sad taste. Rich, it's always great to talk to you.
I think if McMahon was out there the other night, they would have won.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I mean McMahon now.
Yeah, and I'm talking, if I were out there, along with my other, you know, Latin school Romans linemen, we would have won. I've never seen anything like that. Rich, best to you, love to your family, can't wait to see you, and I can't wait to read the next conspiracy column, and then shortly after the next book. It's always a treat.
Thanks, Rick. Great talking to you.
Anytime, you too. He really is a one of a kind, Rich Cohn. Now we're going to talk to another member of the North Shore, R.D. Rosen, who's written this amazing book, where you heard Rich Cohn say what a good book it was. Tough Luck, Sid Luckman, Murder, Inc., and the Rise of the Modern NFL. It's fascinating on a number of different levels, so please stay tuned. Once again, that's a reissue of some Steve Goodman songs, brand new, including some songs you've never heard before. The new CD is called Santa Ana Winds. And I just spoke, as you no doubt were listening, to proud son of Glencoe, Rich Cohn, who's a prolific author, and is now my great pleasure to welcome R.D., Richard Dean Rosen, another proud son of the North Shore of Chicago, a child of Highland Park. Richard, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here.
It sure is. I wish you were in here. I'd love to see you face to face, because we have a number of mutual friends. The great legendary filmmaker, video pioneer Tom Weinberg, he sent me a note saying, hey, you got to read this book. You got to have my friend on. It's the greatest book ever written. And Tom, as you know, Richard, is one of the great enthusiasts of our time. And I said, God, you know,
his opinion.
Yeah. I said, yeah, well, what a small world this is. Why don't you listen to the radio Sunday? When your book came across my desk, your latest book, Tough Luck, Sid Luckman, Murder, Inc., and the Rise of the Modern NFL, I sort of knew the story. I had heard it in a variety of ways, that Sid Luckman had a father who was not exactly the greatest role model. I knew this because I knew Mr. Luckman a bit in his later years, and knew a few people who he knew, people like Mr. Leonard Schaller and Steve Lombardo, who owns Gibson's. But I had no idea of the depth of the Luckman story. You do a remarkable job of not only charting the, you know what the revelation in this book was for me, Richard? It was not so much Meyer Luckman, who was a killer and wound up in Sing Sing prison, but also the compelling rise of the NFL. People, you know, here in the NFL hoopla days don't realize that Luckman and Halas basically set the foundation for what is the current NFL, did they not?
Yes, they did, in conjunction with a couple other brilliant minds like Clark Shaughnessy, who is another coach of the Bears. A number of things happened in that period that really catapulted pro football from its very low status as an American sport. I mean, behind almost high school football, certainly behind college football.
Yeah.
And they did it with the T formation, which was the brainchild of Clark Shaughnessy, who coached for Halas. And one of the amazing revelations in a book that, for me, the writer was full of amazing revelations.
I'll bet.
Was that the inspiration for the T formation was Nazi military strategy in the 1930s, because Clark Shaughnessy was a student of military strategy. He was obsessed with the Panzer general Heinz Guderian, and he had his books translated at the University of Chicago. And to make a long story short, the strategy sparked a notion for an offense full of misdirection and deception, and he applied it to the Bears. He went to Halas and said, "I've got some great ideas," and Halas was smart enough to hire him.
Yeah, that's what Halas was smart. He was also smart enough to draft Sid Luckman. Your history with Sid Luckman, it begins as you write in the book, in 1959, when I was 10 years old, I was fascinated by the new occupants of a big red brick colonial house around the corner from my family's quirky custom split level. Word had spread quickly throughout Highland Park, our suburb on the North Shore of Chicago, that the new occupants were former Chicago Bear quarterback Sid Luckman and his family. Sid Luckman, by 1959, had been retired for some time. He retired when he was only 33 years old, right? You were still hooked. But the seed of this book is the result of a spark more than half a century later, when you have a chance conversation in a suburban Washington, D.C. coffee shop shortly after Luckman's death in 1999. What was the gist of that conversation, Mr. Rosen?
Well, the conversation was actually between a journalist in Washington shortly after Luckman's death and an old-timer, a guy who'd been around in the 30s and 40s, and they were commiserating over Sid Luckman's death, and this old-timer said to the journalist, "But it's too bad about his father."
Yeah.
And the journalist said, "What?" And he said, "Well, you know, he went to Sing Sing on a murder charge." And that is the only reason I or you or Rich Cohn, anybody knows about this, is because of that chance conversation, which I discovered on the internet, because this gentleman in Washington had written a few pages about it in an anthology of his, and nobody paid any attention. This was a few years ago. And, of course, I read about this amazing thing, that the most pivotal figure in the history of the NFL up to that time was the son of a man who murdered his own brother-in-law.
Yeah.
So,
I would argue, too, Rich, if I can call you Rich, that Luckman may have been, I mean, an argument can be made that he as a player was the most pivotal player in the history of the NFL. I mean, James Brown was a great running back, but that didn't really change the game. But that's for another conversation, for a more football-related conversation.
Right.
You started digging, and one of the amazing things about your book is to learn that when Luckman's father was committing crimes, that he was indeed front page news in New York, right? I mean, it was not like he himself was hidden away.
No, no. This is the final astonishing fact about this story. It's not so much that Sid's father went to Sing Sing for murdering his own brother-in-law, although that's terrible enough.
That's pretty big.
It's not so much that Sid's father, who loved football and bought Sid his first football, never got to see him play a single game in college at Columbia or with the Bears before he died in 1944. It's not that the case helped to bring down the Brooklyn Rackets.
Right.
It's not that it made headlines, which it did. The case, the murder trial, and then the bribery investigation, because the Luckman clan had bribed policemen and the prosecutors to free Meyer Luckman and his two associates the first time around. Then he was rearrested, went to Sing Sing. No, the most amazing thing is that the story completely disappeared.
Yes.
Because, of course, we had a very hands-off, courteous media that observed this very bright line between public and private lives.
Yeah.
So I don't know for a fact, but I think it's safe to speculate that what these guys, these reporters, were all thinking was, we love this guy, Sid.
Right.
He's a Jewish kid. He's a great quarterback. Let's not saddle him in print with his father's crime.
I know that is because I imagine, and I'm sure you did too, knowing the way the media works. And I think you have a wonderful line in here, Rich Rosen. We live in a world in which privacy has become almost obsolete. So it may be hard to imagine that the story of Meyer Luckman has been a secret for 80 years, especially since the secret was hardly one to begin with. Meyer Luckman's crimes made headlines in New York City on and off the field for 2 years. When a quarterback has a splinter in his foot or didn't tip enough for the waitress, we'll know about it these days. So that's what makes it even so much more amazing. As you started to dig into, I found Mr. Luckman, as I said, I knew him as an older man, very distinguished, always. He loved being suntanned, didn't he?
He loves a lot of things.
Yeah, right.
Suntans. He loved gifts. He loved women. He loved kids. He loved life. But when you know what he had to overcome as a kid, I mean, this is catastrophic. Oh. To be a high school kid whose classmates are shying away from you in the hall and pointing at you and saying his father's a murderer.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, I mean, you don't do a deep psychological study here, but you get deep enough, Richard Rosen, and that's one of the hallmarks of this book, A Tough Luck, that it is, to me, it kind of is obvious that throughout his entire life, especially in his later years with this kind of, I'm not going to call it a grotesque generosity, but it's a pretty weird generosity. There's a story in here about him stopping in a Tiffany store. You know, he wants to see a dog. He'll give this woman money if she'll show in Tiffany jewelry store.
He gave an older woman, offered her $10 if her little dog would do a trick.
Yeah.
That, I won't call it grotesque, but that's probably the most outrageous example of his compulsive generosity.
Yeah, and he really did. We got to take a break. I'm on with R.D. Rosen is the title on the book. Rich Rosen is the name that Tom Weinberg and I call the author of this fascinating, and it reads on two different levels. If you get the Wall Street Journal, you will have read on Thursday a remarkably favorable review by Richard Babcock, the former editor of Chicago Magazine, now teaching at Northwestern, with a great, you saw this obviously, Richard, it's a great headline, Keeping Mum About Dad. It's a review of the book. You can look there. Sid Luckman wound up being the number 5 in the rankings of the 100 best bears that the Tribune has been running up to that horrific game last week. But tough luck, Sid Luckman murdering.
Talk about a crime.
Huh? Oh, my God. You know, Sid Luckman, if he could get out of the grave, might have been able to win that game. We got to take a short commercial break, and we'll continue on with R.D. Rosen talking about tough luck. Welcome back. I'm on the phone with Highland Park native and Tom Weinberg lifelong friend, R.D. Rosen, Richard Rosen, talking about his amazing book. It really is an amazing book, Tough Luck, Sid Luckman, Murder, Inc., and the Rise of the Modern NFL. There was an incredibly favorable review of the book in Thursday's Wall Street Journal. I am going to be writing about it for this coming Sunday. One of the fascinating things, it is about Sid Luckman and his dad, Meyer, who wound up being thrown in jail for murder, and I think they're very interested. You couldn't have expected, I don't think, Richard, what takes place is sort of in Chapter 8, when Sid Luckman leaves New York, and you write, if Sid Luckman thought he was escaping New York City's climate of organized crime when he arrived in Chicago, he was in for a surprise. George Halas says that he thought Chicago was cowboy and Indian country. He wound up in the company of a number of very influential crime figures and stars such as Joe DiMaggio and Frank Sinatra, but also Sidney Korshak and Charlie Barron. It was a weird kind of galaxy in which he traveled, wasn't it?
Well, it was cosmic almost.
Yeah.
That this young, speaking of galaxies, that this young man would come to Chicago, and Halas, who, whatever his other faults were, he was, not mobbed up.
Right,
would
right.
suggest that Irv Kupcinich, who was a few years older, takes it under his wing. And Irv introduced him to Charlie Barron, a bookie friend of his. You know, everyone had a friend who was a bookie in 1939. And Sid roomed with Charlie Barron until he got a call from the president, the commissioner of the NFL, saying, you're associating with the wrong people, Mr. Luckman. You should find another roommate. Now, Charlie Barron, as it turns out, and I did a little digging here, was a bookie with one murder on his record, murder of another bookie, but he was also widely thought to have been one of the shooters of one of the men involved, one of Capone's men involved in the Valentine's Day massacre,
yeah.
In 1929, I think I've got it right.
Yep, that's correct.
So somehow this really wonderful kid...
Yeah.
landed right in the same tree orchard as his father.
Yeah.
But it was a kind of higher class of mobsters, because I assume your listeners know something about Sidney Korshak.
Yes, who could shut down Las Vegas with one phone call. Yeah. Sidney Korshak and, you know, Henry Crown, Jake Arvey. It is such a wonderful Chicago story, too. And a lot of this happens after Luckman is retired. But Luckman was justifiably a hero to every Jew that walked this planet, was he not? He, Hank Greenberg, much later Sandy Koufax, but there were just... He was heroic.
There are only a few of them. And in fact, part of the impetus for writing this book was I became interested after all these years in my childhood, one of my childhood heroes, Sid Luckman, and wondered why there hadn't been a book about him.
Yeah.
There was certainly books about Koufax and Greenberg documentary.
Sure.
And then I understood why. I discovered why. Because Sid never wanted to be written about, because he didn't want the shame, his family secret, to come out. And in fact,
his children,
I finally met Bob Luckman, Sid's son, to see if he would cooperate with me, I already at that point knew far more about his grandfather and the murder and who he murdered than Bob Luckman.
I know. That's
never really confided in his children.
You handle that so well, Richard. You really do. I mean, you have to, I sense your unease when you have to tell Sid Luckman's son, that you know more about his grandfather. He wound up being a notable figure even long after retirement. He wound up running a sort of company called Cellucraft that allowed him to move into your Highland Park neighborhood, but also to, I think you write, oh, here's your line, Luckman made a religion out of generosity. Do you think that was some kind of form of compensating or you know, atoning? I don't think he needed to atone for his father, but...
No, he didn't need to atone, but he needed to expunge the shame of it.
Yeah.
And just in case, see, this is my theory, and I'll put a lot of money on it. Just in case somebody like me came along during Sid's lifetime and wrote about his grandfather, or wrote about Sid's father,
right,
they wouldn't be able to say, see, of course Sid was a schmuck or a thief or whatever. Look where he came from. So he was building up a protective shell of enormous generosity
and goodwill,
and you know, a lot of people ask me, well, how come if Sid knew a lot of mobsters, he didn't throw any games?
Yeah,
and because of course, if you're a quarterback, that's the guy who can throw the game.
Yes,
that's the one guy you need. And it's really amazing in the NFL that so few games have ever been suspected of having been thrown. But I think the reason Sid. I think Sid was protected by the associates he had in Chicago.
Yeah, I do too. I think
the last thing they wanted as Bear fans and as Jews,
right,
because a lot of his friends were Jews,
no question,
was to tarnish the guy.
Yeah. Well, and I think I hate to read more into a book than an author intended, but I don't mind doing it.
But I intended you to read more into it.
Yeah, well, I read more into it, too. I read some into it that certainly a guy like Charlie Baron and a guy like Sidney Korshak would have certainly known who Sid Luckman's father was. And I think in a way they were being incredibly protective of this very...
Yes.
Charismatic young man.
They had to know.
Oh, no question.
Because Chicago and New York were two incredible centers of mob activity.
Yes.
And also, they might have read the Chicago papers, but, I mean, the New York papers, which were full of the crime only a few years earlier. So they never talked about it.
Yep.
They just protected him. Hallis had to have known because...
Oh, of course.
Because Lou Little, Sid Luckman's coach at Columbia, knew. And after Sid's father went to Sing Sing, he became a kind of surrogate father as a Columbia coach.
No question. He had
to know, and he had to tell Hallis, look, this kid is fantastic. He's what you need for the T formation. He's a great kid. Don't worry about the father. So you would think word would have gotten out.
I don't think there's any question.
But it did. And even Steve Lombardo, when I interviewed him, I said, did he ever talk about his father? And he said, yes, he said his father had been railroaded by the courts, went to Sing Sing. I said, you know what the crime was? He said, yeah, some kind of union beef.
Right.
So even Steve Lombardo, one of Sid's closest friends, really only knew little pieces. And false pieces of the truth.
Yeah. When you go to Gibson's now, ladies and gentlemen, and you get one of those huge desserts, Steve Lombardo is one of the owners of Gibson's, and you get one of those cakes that is the size of a small automobile, Sid Luckman lives on in that, doesn't he? Doesn't he, Rich Rosen?
Yeah, he's responsible.
I know.
He's responsible. He demanded because he had, I don't know if it was Wolfie's in Miami that specialized in these
cakes. Steve has told me that story. It was Wolfie's.
Right. So he shanghaied Lombardo onto a plane to Miami and said, took him to Wolfie's and said, this is what you got to have. You have to have the 8-pound piece of cherry pie.
Right. Rich Rosen, you have done a remarkable job. You've written one of the most compelling books I've read in as long as I can remember. I love sports.
I appreciate that.
And the combination of sports and mob stuff works well in Chicago. I would expect this book to fly off the shelves here. I'm serious. Tough Luck, Sid Luckman, Murder, Inc., and the Rise of the Modern NFL, and Rich Cohn, a notable North Shore author who was just on talking about his The Last Pirate, was raving about your book. I don't know. Have you guys know each other?
No, it's funny. He's a bit younger than I am, yeah. And I know that he was sniffing around the Sid Luckman story.
He was indeed. He wrote something online and went off with a pirate instead. All you need to do, you can read my piece next Sunday or read Dick Babcock's review of the book in last Thursday's Wall Street Journal, Keeping Mum About Dad. A lot of people have forgotten Sid Luckman is just a name to most people, and this story is so much more. I think it is an epic story, and it is told compellingly and enlighteningly and entertainingly, and Rich Rose and I certainly hope to meet you one day.
Well, you will be in Chicago in a couple of weeks to do some appearances.
Come back on the show. And we'll talk some more about cheesecake and huge cherry pies and all sorts of stuff. We'll get Weinberg on the show, too. We'll get Weinberg to do a book review or something.
Let's get Steve to send some cherry pie over.
Oh, believe me, he'd do it. Believe me. Congratulations on this, Rich. It's a remarkable, remarkable book. Yeah. Tough Luck is the name of the book. It'd be really good for you to read during this perhaps a disappointing Bears season. We'll be back after a couple commercials.